Talking DLD.
Developmental language disorder.
1 in 14.
DLD.
The DLD Project.
The Talking DLD Podcast.
Brought to you by the DLD Project.
Hi everyone, welcome to our episode of the Talking DLD Podcast. It has been a little while since our last podcast, and that is all on me, simply because I've been very, very busy writing a PhD, which, as you can probably imagine, has taken up quite a bit of my time. But thank you so much for tuning in. And I'm so excited to be launching our 2024 series with this topic on DLD and speech sound disorders. And I feel remiss that we haven't kind of talked about speech sound disorders and DLD yet on the podcast. So I'm really excited to be joined by Helen Stringer and Yvonne Wren, who are joining us. It's your morning, isn't it? And it's my evening here. They're nodding away. Mm-hmm. I might throw to you, Helen, to ask the first question, which is, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your connection to developmental language disorder?
Hey, hi. Well, I'm a speech and language therapist and a primary school teacher. I'm dual qualified. So for the first decades of my clinical career, I worked with children with really severe speech and language difficulties. And then in 2015, 2016, I was actually on a member of the Catalyze Delphi panel. Mm. So worked with Dorothy Bishop and Maggie Snowling to work together to agree a revised terminology for what was then called SLI. Mm. And of course, now we have DLD. Mm.
Wonderful. So we've got one of the original Catalyze consortium members, which is always great to hear, how that process was undertaken. And certainly something that we talk a lot about at the DLD Project and on the podcast is how important it's been to get to that consensus for research, clinical work and advocacy, and at the end of the day, service delivery. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. So Yvonne, I might throw to you next. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your connection maybe to DLD and SSD, because you're kind of here to help us through this sort of maze of topics around both how DLD and SSD intersect.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Sean. Well, hello, everyone. So my name is Yvonne Wren. I am also a speech and language therapist and qualified a long time ago now and worked clinically for 10 years, including in a language unit, which will mean something to those in the UK. So a unit for children with DLD attached to a mainstream school. But then gradually specialised more in speech sound disorder and then got into research. So I'm now a professor of speech and communication at the University of Bristol and also Professor of Speech and Language Therapy at Cardiff Metropolitan University, as well as being Director of Bristol Speech and Language Therapy Research Unit. But another role I had was as chair of the Child Speech Committee for the International Association of Communication Sciences and Disorders, which is also known as IALP. And we had a webinar series a couple of years ago now looking at terminology in SSD, speech sound disorder. And one of those panels, it was actually, looked at SSD and DLD and, you know, where they overlap and where they're distinct. And I think that's partly part of the origins of what we want to talk about today. But some experience working with children with DLD, but more recently specialised in SSD.
Fantastic. So we've got a really great opportunity to talk across these two topics because they so frequently co-occur, which we'll be talking about. And it's great for me because I mean I'm an academic myself in my capacity, and it was really interesting to sort of stop and think about the fact that how I teach, you know, speech pathology students around how does speech and language come together. And in fact, it's a part of our title in parts of the world, speech and language therapist or speech and language pathologist. So it's really something that is very innate to who we are as professionals. So we're going to be talking tonight or today about the relationship between these concepts of speech and language, particularly for those children who just don't develop the skills as we would expect them to. But I thought it would be really helpful to think about, well, what do we mean by these terms? So perhaps can you tell our listeners what you mean by speech sound disorders? And Helen, I'm going to throw to you for this one, if that's okay.
Okay. So For me, speech sound disorder is the sort of overarching term that covers every sort of difficulty that a child might have with their speech. So it's and thinking about that, it's actually around, children learning to talk from listening to the speech that's happening around them, and adults talking when they're babies. So they're tuning in to the language around them, and that could be one language or it could be many languages. So children grow up speaking all of the languages that they hear around them, and we often hear about the advantage of children who are bilingual for their language, and there's an enormous benefit as well for bilingual children with their speech, because a lot of the underlying issues around speech are the same across lots of different languages, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, perhaps. But for speech sound disorder, we've got this overarching term and then lots of subterms. And really, what we're looking for in using that terminology is to be able to identify very, very specifically the areas of difficulty that a child's having with their speech, so that we can assess them appropriately, delve down deeper into the sort of difficulties that they might be having, and of course, most importantly, come up with an intervention that's going to help them get back on track for, with their typically developing peers. And I think one of the, it's a very complex area, speech. So we have production of speech sounds, but we also then have the use of those sounds in words. And I think one of the things that really differentiates speech and language is, if we're thinking about speech sounds, there are a set number of speech sounds for every language, and children only have to learn that number of speech sounds to physically say them. Whereas words in a language, not only are there millions of them, we could never hope to learn all the words in a language, but also we create new words as time goes on, whereas we don't really create new sounds for speech. So, there is a difference there, and the way we assess is different, and the way we intervene is different as well.
And certainly speech being, thinking about that smallest unit of sound, I really, I'm thinking about perhaps some families that might be li listening in and go, well, isn't speech and language, how are they similar and how are they different? And I often talk about, that smallest unit being that sound production, but we really need to combine those together to form words, and those words have meaning. I think it's about, what is it, 44 sounds in the English language that we're playing around with, at least in Australian English. I'm sure we've got some broader vowels than you do in the UK.
Yeah,
Sorry, Helen,
that's
looks
it.
like you're about to say something else.
Yeah, it's just and it's different everywhere, isn't it? And it's actually probably different. I'm in the north of England, and it will be different to what it is in the south of England. So yeah, it is, we've got the implications of those very, very small units are quite huge. And also it also ties in with the way we listen to language and the way we hear language. So we've got a standard form. A lot of languages have a standard form that's written down, but that's not the same as the language that we speak, our speech sounds, which is why we all sound a bit different, and we can tell if someone comes from Australia or New Zealand or from the United States or from the UK by the way. Those slight subtle differences in our sounds. We can't tell that by looking at people. But we can tell it by listening to them. And I think listening is a really important thing that underpins our speech. Because and also just what we hear around. It's no good listening if people aren't talking. So that whole thing about having language around us, and for babies to listen to people talking and children listening to people talking, is really, really important.
So speech and language are different concepts, but they obviously relate to each other. Can you talk through how do DLD and speech sound disorders relate to each other? Because we know that both skills are really important for communication, but sometimes you can have difficulties in one or both areas. So perhaps, you know, Helen, you might be able to expand on how they're interrelated.
I think they overlap quite a lot. But then again, yeah, they are different. So from the point of view of DLD, we've got their difficulties in all sorts of domains of language. So you could have difficulties with syntax, say. So it might be around using verb tenses or plural nouns. Whereas, so for speech sound disorder, if you've got a speech sound disorder that means you're missing the ends off words, then you're not going to be able to signal a lot of the complex grammar that we need when we're talking. So speech sound disorder can directly impact a child's language. And at assessment point, you have to unpick that to make sure, you know, does the child have a language difficulty or is it a speech disorder that is impacting their language? Similarly, children need to have a lot of words to say in order to be able to properly develop their speech sounds. So as children are growing up and learning words and their vocabulary gets bigger and bigger, they've got more examples of words to pull on in order to develop their speech sounds. And if they've only got a few words in their vocabulary, then that's going to impact on their speech sound development. So the two are absolutely at that early stage very, very interrelated, and they will develop differently in different children as well. So this is, you know, you can't then say, well, we've got to work on the child's speech, otherwise we can't, you know, their language isn't going to develop. What we need to look at is both of those things together in those small children.
And I think your point around the sounds impacting on the word structure is a really big one. I was talking to some students just recently about, you know, final consonant deletion, you know, can often occur in children where they drop that last sound off the word for a variety of reasons. However, if all of a sudden you're dropping out the dt sound in the past tense, like jumped, it's going to change the whole meaning of the word and in fact the whole tense. So it sounds incorrect, but in fact we need to tease apart, is it because they're not producing the sounds as we would expect them to? It's their speech. Is it their language? And when they have both, the complexity of, you know, how do we support the development of both? And I think it's really key because it changes the meaning. And I used to use a little bit of a rude example about, you know, a cluster reduction from truck leading to some not so nice language, that, you know, the occasional four-year-old sounds like they're dropping the F word. But really, the parents might be very concerned, but really they're just very excited about the truck that's driving down the road. So, you know, can't get too worked up about a cluster reduction. And
No, and it's often the grandparents, isn't it, who are most upset.
They come out with some doozies sometime. And I'm like, let's just work out what this process is so we can actually, you know, work on it. So, and they frequently co-occur.
Yeah, and also, you know, some of the really common speech sound errors that we get, like with or the S sound, then, you know, that has such an important role in language, being able to put an S on the end of words. And, you know, if you don't have that, just like you said, you're missing out an awful lot of what's
plurals
happening
and possessives.
In language.
Yeah. And I think it's really critical when we think about reasons for referral, right? So if we think about, and I'm thinking about my clinical caseload here, the number of times children will be referred because they've got a speech issue or need, and the first thing I have to unpick, is it the way that they're saying their sounds, or is it actually the way that the words are going together? Or it could be that they've come in because they're saying sounds that their parents are concerned about, or not saying sounds their parents are concerned about for their age. But as it turns out, when we start to look at it, they've also got co-occurring language. And so it's almost like, you know, the speech sounds can be a little bit more overt, or perhaps something that our ears are slightly better attuned to, but not so much, you know, grammatically incorrect, or, you know, missing those, you know, character setting elements of, you know, macro structure in stories. And all of a sudden it's actually a little bit of a segue into, you know, speech can be this beautiful connection to language, because that awareness of language probably it is not so great in the general population. At least I'll speak on behalf of Australia. Maybe you guys are doing a bit better over there, but I'd say most parents wouldn't know what typical language looked like. But if they heard a speech sound error, they're more likely to maybe pick it up. Would that be similar to your setting?
I think it really is. I think we, you know, certainly in the early years, you get a lot of children who are referred for speech sound disorders because parents have picked it up. And like you say, actually detecting the language difficulties is harder. And it's only really often when children are going into preschool, going into a setting where there's professionals who are working with them, who are saying, actually, this child's got very small vocabulary, or this child's not, you know, still only got two words together in a sentence and they've not expanded. And you know, parents often, they just, you know, their child's talking and they can understand what their child's saying. And, you know, don't actually have the knowledge or the experience in order to be able to unpick what's happening with language. So in a way, I suppose children who have both, you know, DLD and SSD are probably likely to access services a little bit earlier, unless they've, you know, they've got professionals involved with them for other reasons. And also as well, children are really good at doing the supplementary thing around language, aren't they? Like pointing and, you know, if someone's talking to them and asking them to do something, they're picking up the nonverbal cues in order, you know, like if someone's saying, put your shoes on, and they're handing you your shoes, you're going to put your shoes on. Whereas actually you might not understand that particular, the words that go together to make that command. And so, you know, we get a lot of comprehension difficulties that are not recognised until children are older, as well as those expressive language difficulties. So it is, you know, it is quite a problem, I think. But you're right, I think, you know, people do notice the speech, and particularly because it can lead to really quite serious misunderstandings. And I remember clinically we had a little boy who whose speech was really poor, and he couldn't say thank you in a way that sounded like thank you. And his parents were really upset because people thought he was just a very impolite little boy. And, you know, thinking about a goal, one of the things we did is we actually just taught him to say something that sounded quite a lot like thank you. And instantly his parents were happy, and, you know, people looked at him in a different way because he appeared to be, to have, you know, to be the polite boy, which is what everyone wants. So things like that really, really stand out for parents. Whereas actually, yeah, language difficulties don't so much.
And I'd agree that often, I'm just thinking about my own work, I would say that a child presenting with a speech sound disorder and DLD is more likely to come in and see me first. I think the DLD probably gets picked up a bit later, probably because it is a bit more, you know, these children do talk, but they don't talk as well. They understand, but they don't understand as well. So it's a little bit harder sometimes until the demands of school, work, whatever it is, really starts to, you know, take its toll. So we've talked a bit about how speech and language are similar and there's a need to consider it. But actually, we've talked about two separate labels and, you know, there's a need for both labels. So how are DLD and SSD different, and why are these separate labels or separate concepts really important, perhaps in terms of diagnosis and intervention?
If we think about how speech sound disorder and DLD overlap a little bit. What we're thinking about with DLD is around language, and all of the parts of language. So it does include speech, because without speech we don't actually have spoken language. But so that's around how we use language and the grammar of it, and also all the words. So the linguistic components, which are just individual words. And when it comes to speech sound disorder, there's two separate elements to speech sound disorder. One of them is actually producing speech sounds. So that's it's what we call a motor skill. So it's about moving our lips and tongues and coordinating our breath and opening our mouth in the right shape and, you know, the right distance to make the sounds that come out. And every language has its own set of sounds, and those sounds are governed by rules. And the rules are the language part, and the sounds are the sort of motor part. And so children, when they're learning to speak, learning to talk, they say sounds, they babble, they start experimenting with sounds. Yvonne knows a lot more about this than I do. She's done a lot of work with these very, very, very young children. But when it comes to actually saying the sounds, there's also things that can happen that really physically make it harder for children to say speech sounds correctly. So if you're born with a cleft palate, that's going to make it difficult to say sounds. If you have cerebral palsy or Down syndrome, often that can make it difficult. And sometimes there are conditions that we don't know the origin of, and we don't have a label for them, but some children just find it very difficult to make those very, very fast, complex movements in order to be able to make speech sounds. And then there's also a group of children who just sort of pick it up a little bit wrong. So those children who've got a lisp, say, where it's quite an easy thing to change. They just need to practice saying it in the right way. So it's a bit like honing your skills when you're playing soccer, say. The more you practice it for those children, the better they get at it, which is different from the other children who have speech sound difficulties. So there's this whole array of motor difficulties. And so they come into often categories where you've got speech sound disorder that's associated with a cleft palate. We've also got a group of children with childhood apraxia of speech, who find it very difficult to coordinate those movements along with breathing out and the intonation of words when they're sort of talking in sentences. And they find it even really difficult to imitate what people have said, so to repeat back what people have said. And that's a really complex difficulty. And what we're discovering there is that for a lot of those children, there is also a genetic underlying. So, you know, we've got some speech sound disorders that have a genetic cause, and really the majority of speech sound disorders, we've got no idea why children have them. And you know, parents in particular might worry about that, but there's no need to. And you know, we call those speech sound disorders of no known origin. But as time goes on, we may discover more and actually, you know, work out what causes those. But at the moment, it's not a concern for families, because actually we know how to treat them. We know how to help children who've got those difficulties. And there's a lot of evidence there to support that. So from a motor point of view, we've got that, and that is not related to DLD in any way. And then we have the linguistic side of speech sound disorder. So as I said before, every language has its own group of speech sounds, which are have rules which dictate how we put them together into words that make sense in our language. And children are really good when they're small at actually picking out which words are in their language and which words are not. And that helps children who are bilingual growing up speaking different languages. They very quickly work out which rules apply in one language and which rules apply in another language. And they use those to sort of help themselves developing both languages, which is it's just a wonderful thing to see when children are growing up with different languages. And we know as adults which are real words in our language and which are not real words in our language, and that's because of those rules. And so some of that is what we're learning from the language around us, which is why it's so important that we talk to babies, talk to children, and they hear language and we give them opportunities to respond back as well, so that they get opportunity to say all of those things too. And some of that just goes on inside our heads. So we have a knowledge which, for most people, they couldn't, if you ask them questions about it or ask them to talk about it, they wouldn't be able to tell you, because it's a knowledge that we've got inside our brains which helps us to learn new words and to use speech sounds correctly. And as that knowledge develops, it's called phonological awareness or sound awareness. And as that knowledge develops, we can build on that, and it helps us learn to read and to spell when we get old enough. But underlying that, it helps us to learn new words and organize the words so that we understand what they mean, and we can access them if we want to say the word in a sentence. But importantly, it helps us organize the sounds into words so that we are speaking our language. And this is an area that a lot of children have difficulty with speech sound disorder, that they've either not learned the rules, they've not picked up the rules in some way, or they've got a rule that's not quite the same as anyone else's rule. It's a personal rule to them. And that's where you get children who are sort of routinely, say, deleting the last sound in a word, or they might be substituting sounds for each other. And there's some of those rules that a lot of children have when they're developing speech. So they're the sort of typical developmental rules, and children really do grow out of those, typically developing children. But some children who've got speech sound disorder might carry on using those immature rules. So they would be things like, trying to think of a, so it would be something like, instead of saying a sound, they'd say a t sound. So instead of saying sun, they would say tun. And that's a fairly common error that children make. And typically, developing children might just do that for a few months and then they grow out of it. But children who've got speech sound disorder, it could last for years and they need help to get around it. And then there's also other errors that children make, which are quite idiosyncratic to them. So you might get a child who appears to love one sound over another. And so they might just use a t for all the sounds. And so they're very, very difficult to understand, because we've got, nothing really to go on. And sometimes as well, we have children who, I mean, if we imagine that we've got like a roadmap for every word that we've got that lays out the sounds in the order that they come and they help us say the sounds. There's some children who just find it really difficult to make those roadmaps. And I really sympathize with them because I can't even find my way around the building that I work in. My maps generally are pretty poor. So, but if you've you know, if you find that really difficult, what might be happening is that you're just making a guess at the word, and so it sounds a bit different every time you say it. And those children have very, very unintelligible speech because we can't sort of learn their pattern, and it's much harder for people to understand them. I've wandered off your question a little bit.
No, that's okay. And it's part of the conversation. Thinking about the importance of everything you've just said around speech sound disorders has kind of really reiterated the impact of, you know, knowing that that information is there and thinking about our treatment options. So Yvonne, I might throw to you to answer this next question, because I know you've done a tremendous amount of work, particularly with these little ones, as sort of Helen's alluded to, but sometimes it can be really tricky, particularly when kids are developing, you know, they're getting speech and they're getting language, and it's gone kind of this big hot pot of development. And then kids can have difficulties with speech or language or both. What would be your advice to a speech pathologist listening in on how on earth do we tease all of this apart to make best sense of who we're working with and what their needs are?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think the distinction between speech and language, it's really fundamental to our training as speech language therapists, speech language pathologists. You know, this distinction that we learn really early on in our training. But actually, it's really helpful to remember that babies don't have that distinction, that when babies are, you know, developing their very early talking skills, they're playing with sounds, they're babbling with sounds. And what we do as parents and those around these children is when they make a group of sounds, they produce a sound that sounds like a real word, we respond really positively to it, and we encourage it. We give them lots of praise. And so they say that sound more often. And when they say that sound close to that something that sounds like a real word, then it's reinforced even more. So the origins of speech and language cannot be separated. Those first words are linked to those first sounds, and there is no distinction. But we know that as children progress and develop, there becomes a distinction between these two, and it becomes important because of how we manage those differences. You know, and kind of as Helen said, speech in effect is the vehicle for language. You can't have language without speech. But, you know, we do start to see them as two quite separate things. In terms of what we need to do, there are no quick routes to this. I mean, you know, it's detailed assessments, it's you know, the differential diagnosis to try and really unpick what is going on for every individual child. We're challenged by that in terms of the amount of time that we have available. And in terms of, you know, trying to understand what's going on, it's listening, it's assessment. So we might want to look at their speech, work out, okay, what type of speech problem are they showing? And Helen's already talked about this to some extent, and that broad classification between, are they showing more motor type problems or problems linked to anatomy because they were born with a cleft palate or some other craniofacial anomaly? Or are they problems showing more signs that they don't have any motor problems, but they're struggling to develop and learn those rules of speech about which sounds go with each other and which sounds go in which words? And it's important just to throw in at this point that, of course, this is very language specific, and we've used a few examples already in English. We've talked about things like, you know, when we're talking about trying to make past tenses, in fact, and we talked about jump and jumped, and plurals, horse and horses. But of course, that varies with other languages. In Italy, in Italian, you know, it's a change of vowel, not a change of consonant or an additional consonant. So we need to be very mindful of what languages the child we're working with is exposed to when we're looking at their speech to work out what's happening, what type of speech problems are they showing. And of course, we need to do the same thing with language as well. What kinds of difficulties are they illustrating? We need to describe that. We need to also determine the nature of it. And once we've done that, then we can start to work out, okay, are these, the problem with speech, the problem with language, are they two parts of what is fundamentally the same problem? You know, is there a linguistic basis to this problem which is causing DLD type problems, but also causing problems with speech we're going to go on to talk about phonology in a bit, but a problem with acquiring those linguistic rules? Or are they two co-occurring conditions? So there is a DLD, a language problem, and there is a speech sound disorder, and they're two quite distinct things, possibly because the speech sound disorder has an origin in a motor type need or problem, or in a difference in anatomy. So it's quite separate to the language problem. But even when you've got that motor-based problem or anatomically-based problem, you still are developing speech within a system. You still have to acquire those rules. So it's very, very possible to have both a motor problem and a rules-based or phonological problem that might then also link to a language problem. So there's quite a lot of unteasing that needs to happen here. And it is going to be different for each child. So no easy answers to this in terms of advice for speech pathologists. It is about spending that time trying to assess and work out what's happening for that child.
So one of the areas that in the catalyzed paper that, you know, Helen's was a part of in the development was trying to encapsulate this concept that speech and language intersects, and it's really important to consider that children with DLD can and do present with other communication needs. It could be a stutter, like a disfluency, or a voice disorder, and they've tried to capture this visually in one of the figures in the paper, showing, for example, that speech and language overlap. And one of the areas that's seen in this visual is that phonology is an area that can overlap in speech and language, or DLD and speech sound disorders. However, it's one of the points that's really caused a bit of confusion perhaps around phonology and what does that mean for our practice. So I wondered if you might be able to explain what is phonology and how does phonology relate to both speech and language?
So phonology really is about those individual sounds and those small sound units. And every language has its own group of sounds, as we've heard already. And there's different aspects of phonology. So it's, we call it a linguistic skill, and it's studied by people who do linguistics courses who are not speech and language therapists as well. And when children are hearing language around them, one of the things that we seem to innately do as human beings is be able to pick out those languages, those sounds, and hear the sounds and tell them apart from each other. And so that's a really important skill for learning to talk. And as Yvonne mentioned earlier, when children are very small, there's no difference between speech and language. They are so integrated that it's all one thing, really. And this is the bit really where phonology is important, because if we understand and know about the structure of words, then we can group words together that say all sound start with the same sound, and that helps us learn vocabulary more efficiently. If we can put together words that start with the same sound and end the same way, so for instance lots of rhyming words, when children are able to put words together like that, helps them with their spelling and reading, because they can pick up those visual patterns when we're using letters. And then we can match those to the spoken words. So without spoken language, reading and spelling become quite hard. And that is about the phonology of the language. And what we need to differentiate, really, there's lots of terms that sound a little bit the same. And parents in particular might hear people talking about phonology and about phonics when their children start school, and they are two very different things. So phonology is really about the rules that bind together the words into the sounds into words, and they're different in every language. So as a speech and language therapist, we need to be very aware of that and be able to find information about the phonology of different languages so that we can work with children who have different languages. And of course, a lot of that work costs a lot of money because people have to spend time investigating that early development of language. And so the knowledge we have can be a little bit patchy there if we're working with children who speak different languages. But it's not an insurmountable problem. And we can talk to people and find out what the rules are in their language and how they put things together. It's important that children are able to recognize that long words might be split into lots of different parts or syllables. And again, that can be important when we're learning vocabulary. So speaking and phonology are very tied up with learning new words, and we need words in order to be able to use language. So from that point of view, phonology is a sort of crucial part of all of that. And I think as well, that's why it's mentioned in the Catalyse paper, because it is a part of language. But also it's very important part of speech. And if we think about how speech underpins a lot of other things that we're doing, it's the phonological side of speech that is in that position, really. So it's the speech sounds and how meaning is attached to them, and how little changes in phonology can make a big change in sound. So for instance, the example that I gave of sun and tun, then they're not at all the same link in meaning, but there's only a tiny little change in the speech sounds that we use for those. And then when it comes to learning to read, we are translating that auditory skill into a visual skill. And phonics is really about how we assign visual symbols, so that in English and lots of those alphabetic languages that are similar to English or French or Italian or Spanish, then we're looking at letters and how we put letters together, which then translate into the sounds and the words that we say. But we can read silently without saying them out loud, and we can work that out. And spelling as well is all around phonics. So that's a different skill. That's a much higher level skill, really. It's much harder for children to learn. And if they don't have a good basis in phonology, then learning the phonics bit is really hard. And I think that's one of the areas where we need to make sure that children who have speech sound disorders, they're getting their intervention at the depth of phonology that they need. So it's not just about can they say the sounds correctly, it's can they organize the sounds in their head as well. So really looking at what the mental processes are for children when they're speaking, and making sure that if children are coming to a speech and language therapist with speech sound disorder, that not only do they go away with intelligible speech, but they also know how to manipulate the sounds and to create new words and learn new words, which you can't tell that from whether a child's intelligible or not. But that's the key bit then that underpins learning vocabulary and learning to read and spell. So phonology is a really crucial bit, and it overlaps enormously with language and with DLD.
So with that in mind, would a child with phonological difficulties potentially could be classified as having DLD? And we've seen terms like DLD phonology being utilized by clinicians. I'm wondering if you could explain that a little bit further, and I guess thinking deeply about what does it mean for our clinical practice.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. I mean, it's interesting. I don't think that this was the intention of the Catalyze group, that this label DLD phenology would become a diagnostic label. And in fact, when you look at their model, they give equal weighting to developmental language disorder and speech sound disorder. Speech sound disorder is clearly recognized as a distinct classification, distinct diagnosis. Yes, it overlaps because of the language element that is involved in phonology-based speech sound disorder. But I don't think that it was ever intended to be used as a label. And what's happening is, if we are using that as a label, then it's a bit misleading, because a phonologically based speech sound disorder could be one of a number of different presentations. I mean, it depends what classification of speech sound disorder you use. There are several. There's the Schreiberg one, which is based on etiology. There's the Stackhouse one, which is much more about profiling. And then there's the Dodd one with the different subtypes. And in that model, there is phonological delay, there's consistent phonological disorder, and there's inconsistent phonological disorder. So they would all come under that category of a phonologically based speech sound disorder. So if we lump all those together and call them all DLD phonology, I think that is misleading. And I don't really think that that's what the Catalyze Consortium intended. I think what they wanted to reflect was that there is an overlap. When you've got a phonologically based speech sound disorder, you've got a language based speech sound disorder, but it's not in its own right a DLD. That it is actually a speech sound disorder. So, you know, it is challenging, because there is this overlap, which we've said all the way through. You know, they aren't two completely distinct systems. They have their foundation is the same place from babyhood. But once you get to the point of making these distinctions, I think calling a speech sound disorder with a phonological basis that speech sound disorder with phonological origins or phonological basis is more helpful than using the term DLD phonology. But I think it is worth just throwing in here mention of how we have heard that this term DLD phonology is being used, and why it's being used in some countries. And we've heard of this in Europe. It may be happening elsewhere. That what's happening in some countries is that DLD, that there is funding, state funding, for support for children with DLD, and that is fantastic, and that's great to hear. However, there is not the equivalent support for children with speech sound disorder in some of these countries. And obviously that places the speech language pathologist with a tricky position. They want to help children. And a child might present with speech sound disorder, and it might have more of a motoric basis, might be presenting more like childhood apraxia of speech, or might have an anatomical origin or neurological origin, but they are classifying it as DLD phonology, because then the child qualifies for support. So it's important that we recognize that's happening, and it would be good to work with those countries to try and find a solution to that, so that all children with SSD can receive the support that they need. But having that label DLD phonology, you know, if it's not If it is being used for children who don't have a phonologically based speech sound disorder, then there's the danger that they'll have the wrong type of management, the wrong type of intervention. We'll get the inaccurate ideas about prevalence of these different subtypes, because they're being categorized incorrectly. But also families who might be looking on the internet for support are going to get very confusing guidance, because they'll be looking up for something that is a label that isn't the right label for their child. But in summary, yeah, we know that this term DLD phonology is being used. I'm not sure it's a very helpful term. I'm not sure it's what Catalyze originally intended. And I think it would be better if we used speech sound disorder with a phonological basis as a better description for that term. I don't know, Helen, if there's anything that, how you would add to that.
Yeah, I think it's important if we think about the sort of underlying purpose of developing DLD as a term, it was so that professionals working in the area and researchers working in the area used the same terminology and meant the same thing when they used that terminology. So there wasn't any confusion about it, and we would be able to do research and clinicians would be able to use the results of that research and apply it appropriately to children who had language difficulties. And it's the same with speech sound disorder, really. We need to have an agreed terminology, and it, in a way, it doesn't matter if different countries have different agreed terminology, as long as when it, as long as we really know what people mean by that. And so, you know, Yvonne mentioned the different types of diagnostic categories we can use. And certainly here in the UK, we have agreed a consensus among speech and language therapists that we're going to use a slightly modified version of Dodd's terminology. And that's really important because it directly signposts us to the appropriate intervention. And what we're all really working towards is that children who've got speech sound disorder or language disorder are given appropriate support so that they can develop their speech and language and benefit from all the opportunities in life that they can then take advantage of because they're able to understand and participate appropriately as children who are typically developing do. And I think if we lose sight of that at all, we're doing a real disservice to all the children that we work with. So in the UK, we've agreed that terminology, and which basically is speech sound disorder, and then either associated with things like cleft palate or cerebral palsy, or it's a motor, you know, with or without, you know, articulation, and then the phonological disorders, which are, as Yvonne mentioned, phonological delay, consistent phonological disorder, and inconsistent phonological disorder. And we have agreed what those all mean, and they are slightly different to Dodd's original sort of 2005 definitions, but she's also evolved her terminology over time, and that's bound to happen with any agreed terminology. And I think we can probably start seeing it a bit with DLD, that we agree something, but then actually there's lots of research and we find out more, and our knowledge, you know, the depth of our knowledge increases, and we're sort of saying, well, actually it's more appropriate. So in the UK, what the clinicians were saying was, we think that children who have just developmental errors, which we could call you know, phonological delay, if you've just got all those developmental errors and you're 8, that's actually really, really serious. You're going to need a lot of help to get, you know, back on track. And so they want to call that a disorder. Because it emphasizes the seriousness and the need for support from a professional for those children. And that's fair enough, really, isn't it? And I think what we need to be careful of is that it's being driven by the needs of the children and not the way a service is funded or the way a policymaker with no experience interprets what they've read. And I think that's a difficulty in some places, that the voices of the children and the families and the speech and language pathologists are not being heard appropriately.
I think it's a key point to think about how do our service delivery, how does the service delivery drive our work? And, you know, a classic example is in Australia, there might be funding for children who present with scores that are 2 or 3 standard deviations below the mean on language assessment. However, we know that that doesn't necessarily marry up with functional impact in people with, you know, less severe, and I'm putting air quotations around the word severe, you know, can actually have quite significant functional impacts, yet our service delivery and our funding models stipulate. So, you know, people will kind of work the system in order to make sure that the people who need support get support. But it's really hard when a lot of it is driven by money at the end of the day. So I think it's worthy of discussion. And I think just to add a little bit of my thoughts onto the end of that conversation is that often when we're thinking about DLD, I know we can have just one area of impact, but in reality, most children with DLD are going to have multiple areas of language acquisition that they're going to need some support with. So the idea of having just one domain needing support doesn't really fit with the way that I would work as a clinician in supporting a young person. So I think that we really need to think about, you know, what are the needs and who are we describing? Because it's helpful to have these terms, but only if it helps the person understand their needs and those around them, such as clinicians, teachers, families, to support them. So I think that's where labels can be really powerful. So speaking of support, what can we do to support children with both DLD and SSD? Because obviously a lot's happening. I've heard all sorts of different stories, like you should do speech, then language, or some, you know, you should work on this before that. But what can we be doing to support students with both, oh, sorry, children with both needs?
Yeah, I it's a yeah, it's an important question, of course, and I don't think there are any easy answers. It comes back to that need for detailed assessment. And that assessment isn't just about the child's functioning in speech and language, but actually about the impact, kind of as you were saying, Sean, about, you know, the functional impact of their of what, however they're presenting with speech and language. Because it may be that it's not about working on their speech or their language, it's about working on something else which will facilitate their communication. And facilitate their ability to participate and be active in social activities. So, you know, there's not a one size fits all here. But if we are looking specifically at their speech and language, I think it is helpful to think about to what extent there is a common origin for their speech and language. If there is a common, if there is an overlap between the nature of their speech and language, then I think it's worth asking, okay, because there's a common foundation to this, that their needs, is there a way we can target both at the same time? There are some evidence-based interventions out there which can be used to target both. But also, I know that Lucy Rogers, who's a PhD student here in the UK, based in London, that's her area of research investigation. So hopefully, we'll know some more about how both can be targeted in children where they are co-occurring or where they are part of the same underlying condition. So yeah, no easy answers to that in terms of how we support children with both DLD and SSD, but the more we understand the child, the more we understand the family, the more that we understand what matters to them, that's going to be the best guide to us for what to do.
And I liked the point you raised about the interventions around that integrate both. I think that often, I don't know if this is a byproduct of our training, is we, and I think we said this at the very beginning, we see them as quite separate, but they're quite integrated concepts. And in fact, integrated interventions can also be quite helpful for focusing on speech and language. In my experience, and again, I'm putting on my clinical hat here, is I found I've gotten better bang for buck. You know, if I'm working on them simultaneously, and making sure that I'm actually thinking about their needs on a day-to-day basis. Helen, I'm not sure if there's anything you wanted to add to the conversation around sort of these integrated interventions.
I think that's really important because certainly when I trained, we did both, you know, and I think some of it is related to things like the way treatment pathways have developed. So, and that's follow, it's, you know, following quite a medical model in as much as, you know, there's a pathway, a surgical pathway, or, you know, if you've got an illness, there'll be a pathway where every clinician who you see says, oh, yeah, you've got X, this is your treatment pathway. And I think there's been a bit of, certainly in the UK, I think there's a bit of pressure for services to have a speech pathway, a language pathway, a school age, you know, pathway, and they separate things out because you then have clinicians, speech and language therapists, who are specialising as a clinician in a particular area. Whereas certainly for most of my work, I mean, I've worked here at Newcastle University now for about 16 years. Prior to that, I would see a child and do whatever they needed doing, and it, whether it was speech, whether it was language, and whether it was both together. And often it was, you know, both of those things together. And those pathways didn't, you know, exist. So I think there is an issue about how we, you know, organise intervention and how our services are organised. And obviously that, just as you said before, it comes down to, you know, how things are funded. But also I think teaching students, so I teach speech sound disorder, or, you know, up until very recently I did. And it's such a complex area that we have to teach them separately to students, because otherwise we'd be saying to them, you need this huge amount of really complex knowledge as a starting point. And what we have to do really, so that they understand the complexity and the depth of it, is split it up into little tiny portions, which we teach them all, and then at the end go, actually, it could all be one thing.
And that bit
I think is hard. And actually, when you get, you know, when I qualified, we didn't learn about dysphagia because it wasn't a thing. So we had more time to do that. But increasingly, we're, you know, speech and language therapists and pathologists are working with many more types of difficulty. You know, we're moving into respiratory disorders. We've got dysphagia. There's so much more that you have to learn as a student, that sometimes perhaps that tying together, and this is our sort of overarching knowledge or our meta knowledge, is perhaps a little bit lost.
And I always felt sorry for my poor students, because they got me for speech and language, or they do get me for speech and language, and they're, you know, taught to integrate very early. But I think that there's been some benefits in that, and certainly some of our capstone assessments rely on integration. I'm thinking again about how important it is to teach in an integrated manner, so that we've got graduates thinking, hey, these are all interrelated, let alone when you have a child who presents with all of these and other needs as well, whether it's within speech pathology or other professionals, support from other professionals. Now, part of the team is going to be families, and families play a really important role in supporting their child. Is there anything that families can be doing to support speech and language development at home, particularly if they've got a child with both DLD and SSD?
Now, I'm wondering which one of us is going to answer this one first.
You can take
it. Do you want to do it, or do you want me to do it? I don't have any great pearls of wisdom other than something quite generic, really.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I think children just need to hear language around them. You need to talk to children, tell them stories, sing songs with them, draw their attention to language. And it needs to be interactive. So, you know, if you're sitting watching the telly, talk about what's on the telly. You know, if you're reading books, talk about what's in the books. It doesn't matter if you don't read every word. It's telling the story, and giving children that opportunity to hear language and respond to it. And I think that's really for me, it's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think what I would add to that is that I think parents maybe feel that they should be correcting their child's speech. And actually, we wouldn't say that. That's not what we would encourage parents to do. Actually, we just want kids to talk, and we don't mind how they sound. We just want them to enjoy talking. And so rather than correcting them, you know, I mean, you can repeat back what they've said so they hear how it should sound, but allowing children to talk, encouraging them to talk, not worrying about how they sound, just enabling them to enjoy enjoy the experience of talking and interacting. You know, and then, and if they're worried, then seek help, absolutely. But not to correct, just to let it flow.
Hmm. And I talk a lot about serve and return. You kind of, you want to serve it out and see what comes back, you know, that building that reciprocity in what we're doing. And to pick up on your point, Yvonne, I gave the example just recently to a family and said, imagine if your boss walked behind you all day long, pointing out what you did wrong, because I'm sure we all make a few mistakes during the day, and it'd be really annoying. Like, you'd want to turn around and give them a serve, and not a nice serve, a rude serve. So, you know, as a parent, as a clinician and working with families, I can't expect a parent to walk around behind their kid correcting them all day long. It's bloody exhausting, you know. So even if it is a period of correction, it might be short and succinct and really focusing more on exactly what you've both said, which is that engaging in language and speech, talking about what we're doing, you know, storytelling, all of those sorts of things that often to families don't feel like they're doing enough. But my goodness, you know, if they were prioritizing those, we'd be probably all very happy clinicians.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the, you know, as you said about the correcting side of things, I think, you know, if somebody is engaged with a speech language pathologist and they're getting very clear guidance from that speech language pathologist, then, you know, yes, it's doing what that therapist says, but it's not having that ongoing feeling, the need to correct how a child pronounces something. It's just do what the therapist has advised and stick with that. Don't do any more. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So it's probably time to start bringing our podcast to a close. And I do have a question that is my, you know, optimistic question, because, you know, so much is happening around the world in lots of different countries, and things can be quite complex at times. I'd love to hear what your opinion would be on, I guess, or your hopes to see in the future for DLD and SSD, whether it's in the UK or around the world. It could be research, it could be clinical work or service delivery. I guess, yeah, what are your hopes and dreams in this sort of space that we're talking about? Feel free to go first, Yvonne.
Thanks. Catalyze have done an amazing job. That, I think it's been incredible in terms of changing the dialogue and getting a term out there that's got, you know, a lot of acceptance and is now widely in use. In the UK, but working with international partners as well, we are running the mistletoe study. We've completed phase one and we're hopefully moving on to phase two. We're just waiting to hear the outcome of the funding application. And what we've done in that, it's not the same as Catalyze, it's different. But we have agreed a core outcome set so that for future research studies, but actually also for us in the UK in routine clinical practice, we've got a plan for collection of the same baseline and outcome measures for children with speech sound disorder, so that we can use that data to work out what are the most effective and efficient interventions for children with speech sound disorder. Now, what I think will be nice to see in the future, given that we've talked a lot today about the overlap between SSD and DLD, it would be great to be working together more. And there's no reason why we can't. I think it's just, you know, we've talked about how when we're training students, we train them with an SSD and we train them in DLD, and we try and encourage them to think of them together. But it's a time issue, isn't it? So I'm familiar with the SSD literature. I'm not familiar with the DLD literature, and it'll be the same for researchers in DLD. So I think it'd be great if we can find ways within the time that we have to work together more in the future and have some common aims. But in the meantime, I think there's really exciting work going on in both the SSD field and the DLD field separately. Finding some ways that we can bring that together.
Fabulous. What about you, Helen?
My hopes would be very, very similar, really. And that is about seeing speech and language in a more holistic way and joining up that the way we provide intervention for those children. And based on all the new research that's coming out as well, and I think my optimistic hope would be that speech language pathology, speech language therapy would be adequately funded in every country. But I don't, you know, but
that's a beautiful dream. I'll take that though.
Yeah, certainly in the UK, we had a little window at one point when I was a service manager, when actually it did feel like that. And then it just disappeared.
I'm going to probably say change of government or something similar.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, there's such a lot of great stuff happening. And I think, you know, we just need to make sure we're all aware of it, really, and utilise it in our practice.
Absolutely. And think about this coming together. And I'm thinking about the clinicians I work with and the families I work with, and knowing that, you know, these concepts are interrelated. This isn't something new. There is some complexity there, and we all acknowledge that. But it's by being open to the idea of thinking about these areas and how they come together that means we can actually create a better future for the people that we are working with and care about. So I think that's ultimately why we're all here and doing what we do, is to, you know, create a better future for these people. As we draw to a close, I have got one more question. And at the DLD Project, we try to focus on self-care. Now, I'm going to say I'm terrible at this at the moment, and I'm owning that, but I don't think you can be as many weeks out from submitting a PhD thesis without feeling a little bit stressed. But we want to find time to breathe in our busy day. What do you both do to look after yourselves? Throw to you, Helen, this time to answer first.
Yeah. I listen to inappropriately loud, shouty music.
Really? Love it.
So potentially damage my hearing, although I have got some quite sophisticated earplugs that I wear when I go to gigs, as long as I remember to take them.
Excellent.
But live music's my total... envisaging of paradise, I think.
Amazing. Yvonne, do you have a secret revelation for me?
Well, it's similar to Helen's in that it's music based, but it's making music rather than going to, well, I do go to a lot of gigs as well, to be fair. But so I'll play the piano, and I do a lot of singing. So on Sunday, I worked out a 5-part harmony to a Sam Cooke melody. Ooh. And so now I need to share that on GarageBand and get others singing it.
Need to find formal singers.
Sometime in the summer. Yeah. Oh, no, I've got other singers, so it would be fine. But, yeah, I do a lot of singing. And I do dance around the house. But, that just my children and husband get to see that.
Yes, that's fair. I was going to say music's a great thing. Wife rediscovered playing the clarinet after 20 years and has joined a band with a, you know, and then a 12-year-old running around with her saxophone at the moment. And I'm enjoying trying to get the youngest to play the piano after playing the piano for many years myself. I can have a new renewed appreciation for my parents who listen to some god awful piano playing, but that's all right. She's getting good. She's getting there. This too shall pass. Okay, so I guess what I'd love to finish up with are what would be your key points to take away from our chat? And I'm going to give you probably maybe one each, and then we'll confide over the third one. How does that sound? What would be one of your key takeaways? I'm going to say, Yvonne, I'm looking at you, so I might throw to you first.
Okay. I think the key takeaway, based on the conversations, a lot of conversations I've had with SLPs working in Europe, is the challenge that they're facing with having to classify children with SSD as having DLD phonology. So my big takeaway would be, you know, SSD is distinct. It does overlap with DLD, but it is distinct. And it's important that we recognize that, because otherwise we are not going to be managing children's needs effectively. So understanding where SSD is distinct and where it overlaps is probably my take home.
How about you, Helen?
Obviously very similar. And just thinking that speech and language are equally important, and we need, if a child's got speech and language difficulties, we need to spend an appropriate amount of time doing appropriate assessments to actually drill down and find out where the area of difficulty lies so that we can then provide an appropriate intervention for them.
And I might pick up on that and pinch the third point, if that's okay. And I think the thing that I keep reflecting on as a practitioner is, how does my intervention and support look? You know, and it can be integrated. Each child's needs will be different, and use that assessment-driven information. You know, we've got, you know, great information through assessments that we can gather and keep testing your hypotheses. But in fact, by working on speech and language simultaneously, they are integrated concepts, and that we can actually make some really wonderful gains by thinking of it together in an integrated manner, and really help families to understand what it means. Because, gosh, we've used some big words in this podcast. You know, it is a tricky topic to talk about without using, you know, multisyllabic words, but we need to do a really good job of communicating it with families. And I think that comes back to those relationships that we build as individuals, and supporting them as well. So I guess my final word would be, you know, how can we make this as accessible for families as possible? Maybe that's more of a hope for me in the future. But I want to thank you so much for giving up so much of your time to talk about DLD and SSD. This topic has been in the mix for quite some time, so I'm absolutely thrilled that we've been able to take it from planning stages and record it. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful. Yeah. Now, for anybody listening in, and we've talked about any tips or tricks or information, we'll pop those at the bottom of the show notes for the podcast. So check those out. Otherwise, I'll see you on the next episode. Thanks, everyone.